Today's guest is Breanne Davis, and Breanne is somebody who has such an interesting story, and it was such a great conversation with her. She is a little bit younger than most of my guests. She is 39. She qualifies as midlife. I consider 35 and up midlife. And so she qualifies. She has been in recovery. She is a recovering sex and love addict since she was 28. She started the recovery process back when she was 28. She is multi-talented. She is an actress, a writer, a director and producer. She's also a mom and a wife. So quite busy, but she does all these things in addition to helping people who are sex and love addicts. And she has a podcast. She publishes weekly episodes, and it's called The Secret Life Podcast. So I am very interested in listening to it. She says people come on anonymously because a lot of people want to share their story, but they're afraid, you know, of people identifying who they are because of, you know, maybe they're important people in the world and their jobs, and they don't want people to know, but they want to share their story to help other people. And I think that's an amazing service she provides through her podcast. And the fact that she publishes episodes weekly shows a real dedication to the work that she does. And so she's also written a best-selling novel called Secret Life of a Hollywood Sex and Love Addict. And she's developing it with her husband as a TV series right now. So it's about her really true stories in her life, but with fictional characters, kind of like she says it's juicier than the 50 Shades of Grey series. So can't wait to read that. But there's a lot of information about the different shows that she is on. She started, her first film was opposite Jake Gyllenhaal in the film Jarhead. So that was back before she actually was in recovery. So such an interesting, so many good nuggets that she shares. And it was a delight getting to know her and having this conversation. So I hope you enjoy it as much as I did.
Hi, I'm Laurie Wright, also known as Not Your Average Grandma. I created this podcast as a place to go for midlife inspiration. If you are in a stage where you believe the best is behind you, it is my hope that one of these episodes will ignite a long suppressed or unrealized desire, and you will see the potential within yourself just waiting to be tapped so you can do amazing things with the time you have left. I want you to stop seeing your age as a limitation and start seeing it as your superpower. You have years of experience and value that a younger you never had, so it's time to lean into that and use it to fuel your future. No more letting age hold you back from the pursuit of a more passion-filled life. The more passionate we are, the better the world will be. So stop settling for average, put your AirPods in, and let this episode inspire you to take the first step in transforming your mind, body, and soul.
Welcome to another episode of Not Your Average Lives. And today I have with me Breanne Davis. And Breanne lives out in LA, and she is an actress, a writer. She is a director and a producer. She does all the things, multi-talented. And I'd love to hear how you got into all the different things, but she's also a recovering sex and love addict. So I am very interested to hear her story, hear the journey of her kind of getting out of that and finding success. Because when you're in that, I don't think there can be a lot of success, at least not on the inside. So anyways, welcome to the program, Breanne.
Thanks for having me.
Yes, yes. Here. Oh, and I should say a new puppy owner, because she just introduced me to her. Yes,
Morky. New puppy owner.
Yes.
Yes, her name is Stinky Stella. Stinky Stella.
Yes. Well, you know, and that reminds me, because Mork and Mindy in my day was a show. Mm-hmm. And so Morky is kind of brings me back to the Mork and Mindy show.
Totally.
Yeah. So anyway, so take me back to where you were. First of all, congratulations on your success. You have done so many different things. One of the things that makes me curious is, I always think that we have a talent of some sort, even if it's subdued or suppressed. And so you're so multi-talented, clearly creative, you know, kind of an artist. But what do you love most to do?
Oh God. I honestly love everything I do. And that's why I do it. I think you only have one life and you better love what you do. You know, being an advocate for sex and love addiction, almost 12 years of recovery, speaking all over the world, going to recovery centers, being a sober coach for high profile clients, all that gives me so much fulfillment. But then on the other side, I love being an actor. I've been a working actor for 20 years, but then I love directing because I'm bossy and I like to be in control. And then I love producing because I love my hands and everything. And then now being a writer, it was something I never wanted to do, and I'm dyslexic and have ADHD, but you know, it was just the best experience to get over my trauma from my learning disability and putting my story out there and helping other people. I mean, every day I get dozens or more emails, DMs saying how much the book has helped them, my articles. And yeah. So I love everything I do, honestly, or I wouldn't do it.
Yeah. So touch on your book because it's a bestseller, and I didn't even know the terminology, but you use the terminology that means that it's basically a novel with, you know, people's names made up, but true stories. So I thought that's very compelling too.
Yeah, it's a Roma Clef fiction. Roma Clef fiction. And I didn't know what that was. All I knew when I wrote it the first draft in 45 days. It just literally flowed. It wasn't even me. It was like my higher power or God or just was writing it for me. Yeah, it was like a funnel. Because when I was recording the audiobook, I was like practicing reading. And I turned to my husband and I was like, this is really good. And he's like, yeah, you wrote it. And I was like, I don't actually feel like I wrote it. It's my story, but it's other people's stories. So when I was doing the edit and rewrites with my editor, all these other like images started coming up, scenes and movies and things that, you know, in my past and other people's stories. And so I just put it all in there and I was like, it's not a memoir. It's not a self-help book, but it is, but it's also like a chick lit, fun, entertaining book. So yeah, I found out about Roma Clef fiction through a publisher and I was like, that's it. That's what it is. And I'm really, really proud of it. It tells the story of Roxanne, this, you know, late 20s going through her first year of recovery as a working actress. So you get the nitty gritty Hollywood, not the glamour side, like the like day to day, how horrible it is. And then you get, you know, the funny stories with like celebrities, made up names. And then you get, you know, to watch this addict's journey through the first year of recovery and what it is like to live with this deadly disease that nobody talks about, especially as a woman. And you get in the addict's brain. I really wanted the audience to be entertained, but to be educated about this disease.
Yeah, because nobody can really write about it who hasn't experienced it, right?
Right. I mean, it's hard to write about though, you know, when you're addicted to love and fantasy and intrigue and people and using people to fill you and give you that attention and love. And people always think of sex addicts like they're just going and sleeping with a bunch of people, but that's not what a sex addiction is. Really, you can be addicted to one specific person. You could be addicted to an unavailable partner. You can keep going back to bad relationships. You can flirt every time you're out trying to like rape other people over their energy. You can go from relationship to relationship to relationship to relationship, always looking outside of yourself to complete you.
So interesting. So in your book, this person, when you say was in recovery, I was just thinking, oh, recovery for alcoholism or something.
Yeah, but it's right.
Like she's already like recognizing, because I think sometimes one addiction leads to another, maybe. And so like if you you bury yourself in alcohol, then it's easier to get addicted to something else. And yeah, so it's
well, normally a chemical addiction is just the symptom of another disease. So if you're drinking and using drugs, that's a chemical addiction. And when you usually get rid of it, underneath it is an Al-Anon person, someone that didn't have healthy boundaries or a codependent. And then underneath the Al-Anon is usually sex and love addiction. That's not, you know, having trauma in your background, not knowing how to have healthy relationships, not, you know, going for the right type of partner. Really underneath all those addictions is the same thing. It's lack of self-love, worthiness, fear of abandonment, fear of intimacy. All that stuff sits under an addict's addiction. Yeah. So really, yeah, you're just putting one on top of the other.
Yeah. And that's so interesting. I've never thought about an Al-Anon person being somebody with their own set of problems, right? Because clearly, you know, you go to Al-Anon because you want to help somebody else, but then you're like, oh, yeah, they would, maybe the person who you really love, who oftentimes is your child who has the problem, or your spouse who has the problem, maybe you kind of had something to do with that by not setting clear boundaries. Such an interesting perspective.
Listen, you know, if you look at an addict, usually everyone around the addict is usually addicted. They're usually addicted to helping, enabling, you know, love addicts where they're trying to fix somebody else, get someone to be available for them. Underneath, usually I say, if you're with a sex and love addict or with a sex addict or with an alcoholic, there's something in you that picked this person that was unavailable. So that's what you can control. You can't control the addict. You can't control anything outside of yourself. All you can do is look at yourself and do that work and see, why do I keep being in this relationship? Why am I trying to make this unavailable person show up for me when they're incapable of showing up? They're just not capable.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So for my audience, like anybody who's listening, who's like, they're all of a sudden a light bulb went on. Like I'm thinking somebody's sitting here going, you know, I need to know more. What do I do? And I like to leave people with kind of action oriented type of stuff. Okay. What did you do? So like so much learned by example. What did, when you realized at some point this is unhealthy, what happened? Was there an incident that happened? You know, somebody you met, or what was that?
Yeah. I mean, a long story short, and a lot of it is in the book, but what happened was I met somebody that I really cared about and loved as much as I could love somebody, as much as I was capable. I always tended to have one foot in the door and one foot out the other, just kind of always looking, scanning, thinking maybe there's somebody else or whatever. And I thought, you know, going from relationship to relationship or cheating sometimes or having a lot of guy friends and flirting, I thought that was all done. But what happened a year and a half into that relationship, a mentor of mine died. So this traumatic thing happened all of a sudden. And I found myself 2 days later on location shooting a movie, starting to flirt and intrigue really heavily with someone I didn't even like. And I kept thinking, why am I flirting with this person? I really don't even like them. They're not a nice person. And I found myself sitting in a hotel room in the middle of nowhere in Kansas and being like, wow, something's really wrong here. Here's someone at home that I actually really care about and is my best friend, but then I'm doing this and I'm about to blow up my life. Mm-hmm. And it was just this light bulb moment. Like, it can't be everybody else doesn't give me what I need. It has to be something with me. So I called a friend and she hooked me up with her therapist. And when I went and saw her therapist, I sat with her and she was like, you have a secret and I don't know what it is. And she's like, she said this one thing, you wear the mask of one of my other clients that's a high class prostitute. And I was like, so taken aback. Like, I have not had any one night stands. I haven't had many sexual partners. Like, what are you talking about? Like, I am the least person you would imagine not that there's anything wrong with being paid for sex or anything. I was just so taken aback. And then at the end of our session, she said, oh, I know what it is. You're a sex and love addict. And I was like, what? That's a guy. That's a guy getting cheap. You know, caught cheating on his wife. He goes to sex rehab. That's all we hear about, right?
Or somebody that like porn, you know, addict.
Porn,
that's what you
think of. Like, yeah. All that stuff, yeah. Right? And I didn't have a problem with either of those things. A lot of people do, but that wasn't my deal. And she had me fill out the 40 questions. So if anything I'm saying resonates with you, there's these 40 questions, self-diagnosed sex and love addicts anonymous. You type in 40 self-diagnosed questionnaire, SLAA, and we filled them out. And you're supposed to fill it out for your entire lifetime, just not that period. And my number was out of control.
Oh,
it's
wow.
In the book. It's chapter 3. You can read, but it says if you get more than 5 yeses that you might have a problem. And some of the questions are like this. Do you always look for someone to fix you? Are you looking for a soulmate? Are you having inappropriate sex with inappropriate people at inappropriate times? Do you keep going back to bad, unhealthy relationships? Do you find yourself swiping left and right, constantly looking for that next hit? And it goes so on and so on and so on. And it just was like a light bulb moment. I went to my first meeting that night in a room of 30 people in, you know, Los Angeles, deep in the valley, with like an A-list celebrity, a CEO, a janitor, a school teacher, like all walks of life, all ethnicities, all sexual orientation. And every single person in that room said something that I thought, that I thought about doing, that I said, that I almost did. And I was like, oh my God, I'm not broken or alone. Like, there's not anything wrong with me. I've done bad things, but it doesn't make me a bad person. I just didn't get the healthy tools in my background to know how to have a healthy relationships and not to enmesh with people and not to become codependent and needy and wanting them to fill me. And society really messed me up. I saw movies too young. I was always wanting that fantasy, like, you know, Dirty Dancing, Romeo and Juliet, The Notebook. Like, I wanted someone to come in and sweep me off my feet and it to be so passionate. We were willing to die for each other. That kind of, and that's not healthy. And you know, I've been the last decade and a half, you know, trying to break down this stigma of what healthy relationships look like and what fantasy, how deadly fantasy can be. And there's so many people that commit suicide over relationships, lose their sobriety and, you know, chemical addiction, murder people. I mean, just watch the Dateline. It's all about love triangles. So. I mean, I can keep talking forever about this. Sorry.
So it's so funny. The thing about watching movies too young, that really resonates, because I think in this day and age, like my age, you know, baby boomers, you know, a lot of times sex was taboo. And like, I remember my mother would never let me watch movies and things were, even though my parents were pretty, you know, liberal in that, for most parents. But then I look at my kids and, you know, I felt like I had restrictions on them, but yet I remember vividly, and you said Dirty Dancing, my oldest daughter in fifth grade got invited to a slumber party and she came home and she was like, oh, we watched movies. And I was like, well, what movies did you watch? And I never had that conversation with the mom. You know, you trust the other moms to do like what you do.
Right.
And she said, oh, we watched Dirty Dancing. And I was like, you know, and I'm like, oh, so what did you think about it? And she, you know what her response was? She was like, it was so terrible when that girl got stabbed. So I was like, she didn't even really understand what happened in the movie. Yeah. And so it's like her little mind, because she didn't, you know, but like then, you know, the kids in the room did know. Clearly the other kids didn't, because she came home and they had no idea. But yeah, if you watch it with a group of friends, then what do they talk about it? And what do they say? And yeah, that's so interesting about that.
I mean, even kids movies, I mean, Cinderella, Sleeping Beauty, we're always waiting for some shining knight to come and save us. And it's just a bunch of hogwash. Like, it's like, the only person that's going to save me in this world is myself. Like, it's nobody else's responsibility to be that fantasy, to give me that high, because movies, especially at a young age, it literally desensitizes our brains, especially with our sexuality, unrealistic expectations on other people, you know, all that stuff. It really damages young brains. And especially if you see sexuality, if you see porn too early. Right now, they say an epidemic is happening because porn is so accessible, especially to young boys in 6, 7, and 8, that it's going to be an epidemic, because boys are having trouble connecting their sexuality to intimacy, and they have unrealistic ideas of what sex looks like, because porn is fantasy. Movies is fantasy. It's not reality. So,
yeah,
you know, I grew up where I wanted to fall in love constantly. I loved falling in love. It's the best high in the world.
Yeah. So I read that you're from Atlanta.
Yes.
And so you clearly, and you, I don't know how old you were when you moved to California, but you clearly very young wanted to be an actor, right?
So, well, I, you know, got my first job on Dawson's Creek when I was 16.
Okay.
So I started acting, you know, in high school, and I got, you know, I drove up to Wilmington and got that part on Dawson's Creek, but not very, very young, but I was always performing. I was always becoming characters at home. So I think I was constantly acting.
Yeah. Yeah. And I always think about that too, because I think acting, I've, you know, done a few little skits in my time and I'm terrible at it. And so I think it's a real gift to like kind of slip into somebody you're not. And do you think that like your desire to like live in characters kind of contributed in some way too? Or
oh, 100%. Yeah. No, 100%. I mean, my therapist said you pick the worst career for your addiction.
Yeah.
And a lot of, you know, people in the entertainment business are sex and love addicts. We live in fantasy. We go, want to become other people. We want to attach ourselves to somebody new. We want to fall in love constantly. We want the drama. We want to feel the intensity. So I go on set and I'm like, you're a sex and love addict. You're a sex and love addict. You're a sex addict. Like I can diagnose people pretty fast, even though I try not to, but yeah, she said I picked the worst career. It's constant rejections, constantly feeling like you're not enough. Then you get a part and your ego inflates. You feel entitled and it's just a roller coaster. So I loved becoming other people. I love putting on costumes and not being myself. And when I watch myself, I never see myself. So it's this really weird thing.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think the audience wants you to, too. I mean, you're if you have fans, they're like wanting you to fall in love with the leading man, too. I mean, I think about like the what was the movie? And I'm drawing a blank. I know you'll know it, but Lady Gaga with
Stars Born.
Yes. I mean, the remake of that. And you're like, you want them to sing together. You want them to hear that they're like an item. And yeah. So it's
and they had a horrible relationship. He was an addict and she was addicted to him. Yes. And I'm watching that going, yes, that's real life. They are, but it's also, you know, it's amplifying and glamorizing being addicted to somebody and that person committing suicide, which I have so many friends that commit suicide over this, over their partner breaking up with him or, you know, not being enough for someone or. So it's a little hard for me sometimes with movies when they glamorize the addiction.
Yeah. Yeah. And I guess, I mean, in a way what you're doing is saving people.
Yeah.
You know, because you're putting yourself out there and that's not easy. I know you have a podcast too, and you talk about is it called The Secret Life?
It's Secret Life Podcast.
Yeah.
You know, when I came out with my addiction at my 10 years on HuffPost, I wrote an article for HuffPost. You know, I've been in the recovery world with just sex and love for so long that I thought all the stigma and the shame that I was carrying. But when the article came out that morning, I was like, oh my God, did I just ruin my career? What am I doing? This is insane. I don't know why I wrote this article. And what happened was that last bit of shame just kind of evaporated. And I realized how much healing that was for me. And it got 2 million hits like right away. And thousands of people reached out to me saying, oh my God, I've done that. My partner's done that. My child's doing that, all this stuff. And I've been helping people all over the world. And so I woke up one morning, I was like, oh my God, Secret Life Podcast. I'm going to allow other people to share their past or present secrets. A lot of our guests are anonymous. 75% of them are anonymous. And it's everything from suicide attempts, you know, body dysmorphia, eating problems, gambling, you know, getting assaulted by an OBGYN, assaulted by an officer. It's every secret you can imagine.
Wow. I love that it's anonymous. I didn't know because I was going to ask you, I was going to say, how do you find people? Because it's secret, you know, how do they do that? That's great.
Yeah, people reach out to me and I change everybody's name unless it's like Olivia Munn or Jana Kramer, people that come on and say, you know, I've gone through this. Mm-hmm. But I change a lot everybody's name. You will never find out who they are. And, you know, I have people reach out to me. I mean, one of the first anonymous people reached out to me. She shot herself in the chest with a shotgun and survived, obviously, and because she couldn't reach her perfectionism in her head. And for her to walk me through that, that was such a powerful moment. And I was like, wow, this is bigger than me. This isn't even about me. This is not about her either. This is about helping the people that don't have a voice. And that's why my husband and I do the podcast. You know, he's behind the scenes and we just want to help people both. You know, he's in recovery too for 32 years in AA. And we just base our life on helping other people. get out of the
And
street.
That's great. Cause you know, it's the authentic Brianne.
Yeah.
You know, it's the authentic. That's what you're meant to do. And you're doing it every week too.
Yes.
And that's a commitment. That's what I do. And I love my podcast is like the best thing I've ever done. I just love it so much. Get to meet people like you. Just, spread the word.
It's just two people connecting on a very intimate, authentic, vulnerable level, trying to help the listener. So I agree.
Yeah. And it feels like you had a pretty normal childhood. Like, I mean,
no, you need to read the book.
Anybody. Okay. Oh yeah. But it seems like somebody that you would think, oh, she's like the neighbor. She's got it good. She's, you know, middle class, you know, that you just, you never know.
You never know what's going on behind the scenes. I mean, I think that's the beauty of me coming out. You look at my life and you think, oh no, she's got it. She's married. She has a kid. She has a career. She, you know, didn't come from a horrific background, but I did. And I think a lot of us put on those masks to shield ourselves from the pain and to go out into the world and try to do the best we can. But there's something beautiful about like stripping it all down and saying, hey, me too. You know, I came from a broken home. I've had molestation in my past. I've had trauma. I've had a learning disability. I've had a divorced parents. So I think me just coming out and saying and all the stuff that I've been through has helped other people say the same.
Do you think wanting to be a character was part of you wanting to escape?
Oh, of course. Yeah. I mean, I was escaping so early. I remember, you know, the first time I masturbated was like 4 years old because fighting was going on in my house. You know, I grew up in a household where a healthy marriage was never modeled for me. Not blaming my parents at all. They did the best they could. Mm-hmm. But they had trauma in their background and addiction in their background. So, you know, my family, I never saw my parents, you know, say I love you or hold hands or kiss. So when I looked at marriage, I didn't want any part of it. I was like, why would I want to be with someone that I don't really love? And
And that makes me think, you know, like you say the falling in love part.
Yeah.
Cause that's like what you wanted. You wanted to, that was, you don't want that other part.
I don't want the part where you talk about leads to other part. Bills or finances or taking out the trash or picking up dog poop. I was like, ew, I don't want to go through that. I just want to fall in love and feel that euphoria, the first touch, the first kiss. And the moment that would wear off, I'd be like, oh, that's not my person anymore. I need to find who is my real love. And I just kept doing that over and over again. It was exhausting.
Yeah. So sounds like you had a great therapist.
Oh my God.
Kudos to her. Yeah. So what else did you do? Because I know it's a lot more than just like getting a therapy session. So did you turn to books? Do you like self-help books? Was there a podcast or was anything that you could recommend a listener?
Yeah. I mean, I worked my 12-step program in Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous. I did all 12 steps. It took me 9 years. I did 8 years of intense therapy twice a week with my therapist. I did body work. I did Reiki. That was really good. Moving energy. Mm-hmm. You know, meditation, going to retreats. I've read, you know, Facing Love Addiction by Pia Melody. I've read Emotional Incest, What Not to Do When You're a Parent, which is an amazing book. If you're a parent, you should read it.
Great.
Yeah, I've done trauma work. I'm really an explorer of trying to get that trauma out of your body. And the first sign of it is if there's any drama in your life. Do you have any drama with relationships? Do you have people in your life that don't show up for you? Like you're a good friend and then they are not great friends? Or do you have parents that don't know how to respect your boundaries? Are you a parent that doesn't know how to respect your child's boundaries? Mm-hmm. You know, so it's really about relationships, looking at the relationships in your life, not just people you're physical with or sexual with or in love with. It's about all relationships. And what I realized, all the work I did, is that I was using every single person in my life to fill me, to give me my self-worth, friendships, family members, you know, my partner. And I just couldn't do it anymore. So I really, you know, leaned into service, going and I talk about it in the book, doing community service, giving outside of yourself, you know, it's not about you. You're a little teeny person on this planet. And I'm a worker among workers. I'm no better, no less than anybody else. So doing that work, body work, inner child work, 12 steps, therapy, you know, then going to meditation and prayer, finding my own form of God,
yeah,
all of that. It's a combination of all of that.
Yeah. Knowing that there's something outside of you.
Right? Always. That's,
yeah. Yeah.
Because I was so selfish and self-seeking. Mm. And as an actor, you have to be very selfish. It's a very hard career and it's all about you. But that is not a healthy way to live. You are not the center of the universe.
Yeah. It can be hard to lose sight of that, though. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, yeah, when people pay to watch you and entertain you and that sort of thing. So, yeah. So what I mean, what I love is that you – what you desired in life to be an actress or actor, and you went after it and very successful, but it's like the passion that comes from within you is all about your journey and sharing that with others and helping other people. And that's like really where your star is shining. That's so incredible.
Thanks. Yeah, yeah. I'm not saying that it's my purpose, but it definitely, when I hit my 10 years and got my 10 year, you know, chip, we get these chips with 10, the number 10 years. And it's like something happened when that chip fell in my hand. And I was like, wow, I've been of service to my community, which is 30 million people in the United States are sex and love addicts. That's just, and that statistic is 6% of the United States. That statistic was 7 years ago. And I'm just telling you, the rooms have exploded, especially with younger generations coming in and not having healthy relationships, knowing how to connect intimacy and sexuality. So, I just love helping other people. That really fills me. That really gives me a sense of purpose that makes me, you know, see that even if I have a bad day, if someone reaches out to me and I help them, that makes me have a better day to be of service, and that, you know, this too shall pass, and that, you know, feelings are meant to be felt, and I'll feel those feelings and I'll be of service and it will get me on the other side. I mean, being of service really is the 12th step in any 12-step program because that keeps an addict sober. It's accountability. It's giving back. The serenity and peace that I feel today, that I can walk out in this world, not flirt, not intrigue, not look outside of myself. No job completes me, no money in the bank, no nice purse. All that stuff used to be everything to me. And now I walk out into this world and I'm complete and whole as a person by myself. My husband can leave me. My child could leave me. Both would devastate me, but I would be okay. I couldn't say that 12 years ago.
Wow. Powerful stuff. Thank you for that. Yeah. What I've learned about purpose too is, and it's exactly as you described, it's the activity that fills you up. And once you identify that, it can take many forms. And so you've recognized, you know, you love to help people, you love to serve in that way, and you'd get to do it in a lot of different ways. And it probably doesn't get too boring, which is great.
No, my life is definitely not boring at all. And I thought it would be. And I thought, what do you mean I don't get to flirt and intrigue? What do you mean I don't get to like go from relationship to relationship? What do you mean? Like, I want to be enigma in this world that no one can touch me. But I was like, that's going to be the most boring existence known to man. But honestly, it's so freeing. It's so freeing to be filled by yourself and nobody else. I never thought I would ever experience this serenity and peace and freedom.
Yeah. Yeah. It's like, you know, I think the former life that you had, it's like, you know, having a map, but never finding the destination. You know, it's like, I'm lost. Where I can't get there. I can't find it, you know? And then when you like come to where you are today, it's like, oh, I've always been here. This is it, you know? And I don't need that map. Yeah. So cool.
Well, it's true. And then you always think like, oh, if I book a series or if I get that movie in that starring part. And when I did get those things, I just still felt so empty. And it was like, okay, my perception of what's important in life is so distorted and I'm still empty and searching outside of myself. I have some major work to do to figure out why I feel the way that I do. And that was important to me.
Yeah. And it sounds to me, I think when I think of an actor too, I think of, lots of reliance on ego there, very ego driven, and you let go. I mean, cause that's like, that it takes like to get away from the ego and say, to go inside and to like, I need to explore this. I need to figure this out. That's like, really letting go and not.
Well, you know what ego stands for, right? Do you know what that stands for?
Tell me.
Edging God out.
Oh, I have not heard that.
Yep. Yeah.
That is so good.
Ego is when we all think it's about us and you're not relying on God, let the whole thing about letting go and letting God, like, whatever's meant to be is meant to be. If something great comes to me, it's not me, it's God. That's my path. And if something bad happens, there's a lesson there and that's my path. So yeah, it's edging God out.
That's good. I'm surprised I haven't heard that. Yes. Thank you for that.
You're welcome.
The episode. Well, thank you. Are there any last words you'd like to leave with the listeners? Any looking back, what's the one thing that you have learned that you think like you want your son to know? Cause you have a little son, a little toddler, and you're a mom and you are definitely going to be a model of his growing as he grows up.
What I want to teach him is that he's enough just as he is and that he can survive anything. And like I said, feelings are just feelings and they're meant to be felt. And we think, if we're sad, we're always going to be sad. And especially as an addict, it's amplified even. It's hysterical. It's historical, situation. So I really want to teach my son how to feel his feelings in a healthy way. I feel like they should teach that in school, to allow especially young boys to cry when they need to cry, to have their emotions. But then I also don't want to enmesh with my child. I don't want to, put my needs on him. So if mommy's having a bad day, I'm not going to ask my son, hey, give mommy a hug. I'm having a bad day. And I think those boundaries with my child will help my child successfully navigate this world of ups and downs. And also teaching him, not everybody's going to get a trophy. You're not going to be number one. You honestly, I love you and you're a great kid, but you are not unique and special. You are a person on this planet that needs to be kind and caring to other people. And I think my addiction and my recovery has taught me that we are all here on this planet trying to make it a better place. And then I guess if anybody's listening and resonates, it's never too late to change. I come in the program and I sponsor women and sometimes men, in their 60s, in their 50s, in their 40s, older than me. And it's never too late to stop looking outside of yourself. Because honestly, the moment you stop doing that, there's this overwhelming feeling of self-love and you fill yourself up. And that's what this journey has given me, is self-love. I didn't have it before. And I can say on my deathbed now that I have connected to other people on this planet and been of service and had both feet in relationships, but also I'm my own fucking soulmate. Like no one is going to rescue me. I have to rescue myself.
Yeah.
And it's never too late to do that work.
Yeah. I heard something recently that was interesting and struck me, because it's like, the Notebook and how it ends, and it's like, it's like they died together.
That's like the number one movie in my program not to watch. It's like,
we're not going to die with, we got to learn how to love ourselves, but we're going to be by ourselves in the world.
That's my last chapter. I have rules in the book, and rule number 10 is you better love yourself the most, because you die. You're born with yourself and you die with yourself. No one else is going with you. And that money's not going with you either.
Yes. Yes. So good. So good. Thank you so much for being here. It was a pleasure meeting you and getting to know you. And yes, good luck with your Stella.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for tuning into the Not Your Average Lives podcast. If you haven't yet, make sure to subscribe on iTunes if you have an Apple device. You can find free resources and learn what else I have going on at the moment that might interest you on my website at notyouraveragegrandma.com.
You can also find me on Instagram or Facebook at Not Your Average Grandma. If you liked this episode, it would make my heart so happy if you could leave me a 5-star rating. You can also add a review to let me know what you like about this podcast, which will help spread the word about it to others who need a little midlife inspiration. As always, be you, listen to your inner voice, and focus on reigniting that lost spark so you can start living your own, not your average, life.